1234. You are tuned in to 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. And since 1976, Northern Community Radio has been telling the stories of the people in the land of northern Minnesota. Text the word donate right now. 218-326-1234. Now we join Weekend Edition Saturday here on KEXE.
Southern California today, where lifeguard Pono Barnes says that could mean hundreds of rescues on his beach alone.
Those days where you're just in the water making rescues with your buddies and you go home absolutely exhausted, but you feel great.
And then Michelle Steele with sports. Is FIFA in retreat? First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, August 1 already, 2026.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Minnesota's lakes have been less refreshing this summer amid rising water temperatures. But for fish, the heat wave can be deadly. Stella Mayerhoff has more.
The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has seen a rise in water temperatures and reports of dead fish. Over 200 fish mortality reports have been submitted so far this year, including several events involving hundreds of dead northern pike. Certain species and larger fish in general are at higher risk due to their anatomy. Nearly a third of mortality events took place over four especially warm days in July. Cold water fish, such as Lake Cisco, become stressed at 75 degrees. In some places, surface water temperatures have soared to 85 degrees. Water temperatures during Minnesota winters are increasing, and this summer is no exception. According to climatology data, lakes are about 3 to 4 degrees warmer and have lost an average of almost 2 weeks of ice cover in the last 50 years. You can report fish mortality events on the Minnesota DNR website. Stella Mayerhoff, Report for America Corps member for KAXE News.
Aircraft are playing a critical role in the Superior National Forest firefight. Photographer Lori Shaw visited Ely's historic seaplane base this week, and Aaron Bowman brings us the story.
Crew members were fastening canoes to 60-year-old red and white beaver seaplanes on Wednesday. The planes were being prepared to bring the sawtooth hotshots of Idaho and their equipment into the National Forest. The highly trained, specialized wildland fire crew will continue the week-long fight against several lightning-caused blazes burning in the remote wilderness.
They're actually going to have to unload the canoes, work their way into where they're going to go into, and make sure that they're able to put some fire line in a particular spot.
John Fish is the Air Operations Branch Director for the Wildfires Management Team. He says the team is starting its 2 to 3 week assignment, where members will work 14 to 16 hour days. The Ely Seaplane Base is the only Forest Service seaplane base. It's home to 3 of the 6 beaver float planes the Forest Service owns. Since the fire started in July, over 627 hours have been flown. 3 million gallons of water and 120,000 gallons of fire retardant have been dropped. As they have gained more control over the fires, aircraft have left the National Forest to help other fires in the U.S. But Fish says they still have plenty of help here. As of Friday, the biggest fires range from being 38 to 70% contained. Aaron Bowman, KAXE News.
The University of Minnesota's Natural Resources Research Institute, or NRRI, has launched a new simulator to test innovations in iron refining. Emma Crabb has more from the launch event in Coleraine.
The simulator is a direct reduced iron furnace, which uses gas like hydrogen or carbon to strip oxygen from iron, making a pure product. Direct reduced iron is not a new product, but furnaces that use it are becoming more popular in the steel industry. The range's newest mine, Mesabi Metallics, will use this method, and Keytac added the capability a couple years ago. But experimenting with the newer process at a commercial level is costly. NRRI Taconite Chair Brett Spigarelli says this is where the research comes in.
What this furnace will do essentially is allow the industry on the range right now to de-risk transition into this industry.
At around 2,000 pounds, Figarelli says their machine is about 20 times larger than other testing simulators. This makes it more accurate and scalable for commercial sizes. What does the metal machine actually look like? According to Spigarelli,
it looks just like a big potato that you can take the lid off of and then you can put stuff inside of it.
The launch event Thursday focused on the team of researchers, government officials, and industry professionals who got the simulator over the finish line. This includes the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, which provided a $600,000 development grant to the project in addition to $2 million in matching funds. Commissioner Ida Rukavina says most of the department's funding comes from taxes levied on the mining industry.
This means that dollars generated by mining stay here in the region, supporting our communities where mining takes place.
Spigarelli says the project was funded through a mix of national, state, and NRRI funding. Emma Crabb, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The U.S. continued its strikes on Iran this week, and Tehran responded by hitting U.S. targets across the region, as well as tankers being escorted by the U.S. in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian-backed militias and proxies are now playing a bigger role in the conflict. This week, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia carried out airstrikes on Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. We're joined now by Ray Takei. He's Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We hear a lot about Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, which Iran helped form, but we haven't heard as much in recent years about Shia militias in places like Iraq. How active are these groups?
The Shia militias were really came to their own in Iraq in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion in 2003, when the Shia community began to mobilize politically. And of course, there was a civil war in Iraq that had a sectarian color to it. And that's where Iran really became active in mobilizing various Shia groups into militias. Not all Shia militias were under Iranian control, but some of the critical ones were, particularly Qutb Hezbollah, which is its core ally in that country today.
And how much support do these armed groups get from Iran?
In terms of logistics and military and so forth, it's quite substantial. But many of these Shia militias and their representatives are in some ways now integrated into Iraqi political structure and ministries. And that gives them access to the resources of Iraq, but also at the same time gives them additional support from Iran. So in this sense, Iran has its tentacles into the bureaucracy of the Iraqi government, such as Ministry of Intelligence. And that's where a lot of influence comes.
Help us understand the balance between these groups being outright proxies and the degree to which they act at the command of Iran or in Iran's interests.
Well, not all proxies are alike. And Hezbollah in Lebanon has always been Iran's most important ally and its most compliant ally. Houthis, on the other hand, in Yemen, tend to have their own mind, and they tend to cooperate with Iran when it's in their interest, as they see their defined interests at the time. Shia militias are a little different stories. The Badr Brigade, which is the one Iranians created in the 1980s to fight Iraq, that's actually less responsive to Iranian direction today than Qutb Hezbollah, which takes a lot of logistical assistance from Iran. So it varies from group to group. But the core groups are much more in line with the Iranian objectives today.
Mm-hmm. But they still have their own domestic agendas, certainly.
They must, because they're still operating in a contested political environment in Iraq. And they have to abide by the kind of a complexity of Iraqi politics. But Iran has an important source of leverage over Iraqi politics because of its connections to the Shi'i community, or at least important segments of it.
What role might they play in a widening conflict?
Well, as both sides escalate incrementally, the United States and Iran, they both try to have as much resources at their disposal and points of leverage. For the United States, the points of leverage are obvious: putting pressure on the Iranian economy through selective military strikes and punishing strikes in hope that it eventually comes to terms with the United States. For the Iranians, the points of leverage are less obvious, but also have proven quite powerful. For instance, closing the straits in the Persian Gulf and activating the proxies as a means of having another source of retaliation against the United States.
Mr. Takei, Iraq called the Saudi U.S. bombing there this week a flagrant violation of its sovereignty. Could bombing the countries where these militia are based and where they operate widen the conflict and further destabilize the region?
It certainly has that feel to it, and sometimes widening the conflict doesn't necessarily reduce the possibility of conflict coming to an end. It sort of reminds me when Richard Nixon started bombing Cambodia in order to get peace in Vietnam. It didn't work then. I'm not quite sure if expansion of this conflict works in this case as well. These groups now may actually retaliate against Saudi Arabia. They're pledging to do so, and that creates another dynamic of violence, counter-strike and strike and so forth that we have seen across this region.
Does the Iranian relationship with these groups give Iran a stronger hand when it comes to ostensibly and perhaps making some kind of agreement with the U.S. to end the conflict?
Well, both sides, the United States and Iran, are seemingly open to diplomatic engagement. However, they both want the diplomatic outcome to be defined by their terms of preference. So at this point, they're both using all points of leverage that they have in order to impose those demands on the other side. And that's why you don't have negotiations that are meaningful at this point, because both sides think they're going to pressure the other one into compliance. And the president said it, I think, yesterday when President Trump said, look, at some point they can't take this level of bombing and hits, and therefore they're going to come to the table and make an agreement that is satisfactory to us. That is a logic of incremental escalation. That is a logic of saying we can take the pain more than they can. It's a dubious logic in past encounters on American military affairs. Whether it'll succeed in here, I'm not sure. I have my doubts.
Ray Takei is with the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now it's time for sports. The FIFA World Cup, no longer up for sale. Michelle Steele joins us. She writes the Steele Cut Substack on sports and markets. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Let me try and put this in order. Tuesday, the Times of London reported that FIFA president Gianni Infantino planned to allow private investors to get a 20% stake in its most popular tournaments, including the World Cup. Thursday, European teams threatened to boycott. More teams threatened to join that boycott. And last night, FIFA announced it was pulling back on the plan. It lasted about as long as a hydration break. Why did it last so quickly? Or why did it collapse so quickly?
Yeah, a hydration break might be generous, Scott. This didn't even survive a normal work week. I think this is like half a Scaramucci or something. And credit where it's due, Martin Ziegler at the Times with this massive story breaking on Tuesday, Infantino's plan to sell up to 20% of a new $20 billion entity bundling all the commercial rights to the World Cup. And you mentioned the Kushner family involved. Jared Kushner's brother Joshua was expected to lead the investor group. And then UEFA, which is the biggest, most powerful confederation in the soccer, in the sport of soccer, objected. And they didn't just object. They voted to boycott every FIFA competition, including the World Cup, until the plan was dead. You had the COO of FIFA saying his own staff had been deceived. And by last night, Infantino announcing the project will not proceed. Scott, breaking literally this morning, UEFA coming out and sort of doubling down, saying they've lost confidence in Infantino entirely. So this story is fast moving and not over by any means.
Why all the criticism? I mean, it would have meant a lot more money.
Sure. I mean, that was the selling point to some of the poorer confederations in the sport, that they would get sort of this upfront payment. Well, you know, there were a couple of reasons why the criticism was so harsh. One was the head of the German Federation said he found out by reading media reports. So when you don't have a communication strategy to your principals, that's going to be a problem. The other part of it is very existential. And UEFA said it outright, quote, the World Cup is not for sale. They said that in their statement. The fear is when you bring in outside investors and you allow them to have a stake and make decisions about the calendar and format, hey, you know, let's figure out what maximizes returns is going to be your guiding light instead of what's good for the sport. You can see easily a world where the World Cup has to be in the United States every time, or another rich country, because that's where you're going to be able to maximize prices on everything. And that's how you have a full-blown crisis on your hands for Infantino and for FIFA.
And I have to ask, because before this week, Gianni Infantino looked to be, you know, coming off a very successful World Cup, looked to be cruising to re-election for another four-year term as FIFA president. The election's now going to be held next March. He doesn't have such a lock on the job anymore?
I don't think so. We'll see if he even lasts until March, because UEFA is certainly not standing down, saying that they not only lost confidence in Infantino, but many other members of the football family. They called the whole scheme a shabby, backroom, opaque deal. Them's fighting words. Whether Infantino survives as president is now a real question, because UEFA says they will work in the coming, quote, days and weeks to devise a plan so that this never happens again. It shows the power of coalitions here, Scott, because other football associations are coming forward and backing UEFA on this.
Michelle Steele, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you next time.
It is 8:17. Thanks for tuning in. It's Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE Weekend Edition Saturday. I'm Heidi Holton, sitting in on this special day of August 1st, the final day of our summer membership drive. We want to get it off to a great start because we want to make our goal by tonight of $50,000. You've helped us all week long, but maybe you finally have a moment right now. You didn't quite get a chance to do it. We need you. The next two means we unlock an extra $500 when you pledge your support. We've heard from three people so far. You can go to kaxe.org, or I'll take your phone call, 218-326-1234. Coming up, we're going to be learning about Colorado River water cuts and also tariffs and forced labor. Lots that you get from KAXE, including local news. We had just heard the Up North report. And national news, like what's coming from Morning Edition Saturday here. Thanks for being with me this morning. I sure appreciate it. Good to talk to you when you call in or you text what you are up to this Saturday. 218-326-1234. It is Doc Moonlight Graham Days in Chisholm, and that is now through tomorrow. Activities today include a Field of Dreams comedy baseball show at noon and a parade at 3. You can find the full schedule at chisholmchamber.com. And tomorrow, Bemidji Area Community Band is performing Summertime Classics at 7 p.m. The performance will be at the Bangsburg Fine Arts Complex at Bemidji State University. See, is people-powered radio. Here's a poem written for John Latimer from Prairie Creek Community School in Northfield.
I never noticed how
fawns jump
Fox kids play.
A bald eagle perches.
Pete color hits.
A murmuration of birds cover the sky in a flapping of wings.
I'm mesmerized.
Excited to watch.
Sometimes the littlest things are best.
Noticing the clouds.
The wildflower in my backyard.
The changing leaves.
The hidden mushroom.
The birds singing their usual song.
My backyard holds generations.
All the little things gather into one big thing, a season.
When I was small, I didn't notice.
Now I ask questions. I pay attention.
I look delicately.
I welcome the spring's first heron.
I say goodbye to the fall's last dragonfly.
I have a whole new way to see the world.
The process of asking questions, testing, and trying again, even when it's not easy. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at hewlett.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. There's a new federal plan for sharing the limited water of the Colorado River. The Interior Department's proposal, released yesterday, calls for potentially huge cuts in water use in coming years for California, Arizona, and Nevada. The Colorado River provides water for more than 40 million people in 7 U.S. states and dozens of tribal communities, but is facing severe drought conditions fueled by climate change and continued heavy demands. Alex Hager covers water issues at member station KJZZ in Phoenix. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I gather this federal plan's a 10-year framework. What are the biggest changes?
The river is vital for big cities, small towns, and a huge farming industry across the Southwest. And this new plan offers a very wide range for how much water could be cut from them. Under the worst-case scenario, the federal government could cut water by up to 40% for Arizona, California, and Nevada. That would be massive. The plan forces states to come together every 2 years and adjust the rules. Some experts say that's not the kind of long-term stability these cities and farms need. I talked about it with Elizabeth Cobley, who researches water policy at the University of Nevada, Reno.
I'm not very confident that there's a lot in here that would get us beyond the challenges we've seen over the last couple of years and this pattern of managing crisis to crisis that the basin has really been in lately.
The Interior Department is expected to announce the exact size of cuts for the next 2 years in the coming days or weeks.
And of course, the Colorado River Basin is facing some of the most severe drought conditions on record. How are the states most affected, Arizona, California, and Nevada, preparing for the potential cuts?
Yeah, we expect the hardest hits will come for Arizona, specifically the millions of people in the Phoenix area. But taps are not going to go dry anytime soon. That's because local utilities have been preparing for this day for years. The Colorado River is not their only source of water. So when they get less from the Colorado, they can lean a little harder on a different source, like groundwater or a different nearby river. But shifting to new sources and planning for the long-term future, that will be difficult and expensive.
Alex, what's the reaction been from these three states?
There's some disappointment so far. In Arizona, leaders say the worst cuts proposed under this plan are unacceptable and that they would devastate Arizona's economy. Arizona's U.S. senators, both Democrats, they said the cuts put a really unfair burden on the state. But Arizona officials do not expect that those big 40% cuts will become a reality, at least for the next 2 years. They have a counterproposal that they hope the federal government will implement. They are volunteering big cutbacks, you know, about 20% less water. It's still a big deal, but they would deal a little less pain to the Phoenix area.
And what's ahead for this plan? Is it already done?
Water managers say this new plan leaves the door open for states to come back to the negotiating table and finally agree. Tensions are still really high, but John Berggren with the conservation group Western Resource Advocate says this new plan could make a difference.
Clearly, the last 2.5 years of negotiations hasn't worked, so let's change that up. Let's use this as an opportunity, as a pivot point to start something new and get to that 7-state agreement.
But there are still some deep fundamental disagreements between the states in these negotiations. The upstream states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, they argue they shouldn't have to take mandatory cuts at all because they already get less water due to drought and climate change. So the states are still far apart, and some of them haven't ruled out suing each other or the federal government.
Reporter Alex Hager with member station KJZZ in Phoenix. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last week, the Trump administration announced a new round of tariffs covering more than 80 countries, virtually all imports entering the United States. The administration says these countries have not done enough to enforce bans on goods that are produced by forced labor. But just hours after this announcement, two small businesses challenged the tariffs in court. One of them is Burlap and Barrel, the New York spice retailer that successfully challenged a previous set of tariffs at the Supreme Court. Scott Linsicum is the Vice President of General Economics and Trade at the Cato Institute, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
How steep are these tariffs?
In one sense, the tariffs are historically steep. You're setting tariffs at around 10% to 12.5%, which is a radical increase from where the United States had sat before 2025. In another sense, though, the tariffs are basically the same they were a couple weeks ago when another set of tariffs was in place and then just expired. So as an economic matter, big historical increase, but relatively modest change.
What do you make of the administration's argument that this was necessary to reduce forced labor?
Yeah, I'm extremely skeptical for several reasons. The first is if you actually read the report that the government issued, it is extremely light on actual evidence. It makes no connection between the allegation of forced labor enforcement in these various countries and any harm to the United States, which is the legal requirement for imposing tariffs. It also doesn't explain how these tariffs will achieve the end to these forced labor problems, nor does it justify why good actor developed countries like, say, Norway are getting the same tariff rate as countries that have serious forced labor issues, such as Kazakhstan. You put it all together, combined with the fact that the administration has been for months promising that they would have these tariffs in place at around these levels. And I think it gives us a lot of reason to doubt that this is really about forced labor instead of just restoring the president's tariff wall.
But forced labor is a problem, isn't it? I mean, shouldn't the U.S. Be taking steps to try and push trading partners to end forced labor?
Well, forced labor is an issue. But the reality is that the United States has had a ban on imports made with forced labor since 1930. The United States has actually been a somewhat weak enforcer of that law over the last several decades. The Trump administration has been a lighter enforcer than the Biden administration was. So I think we can all agree that attacking imports made with forced labor is a worthwhile cause. The question is simply whether the administration really has good intentions here and whether these tariffs are actually going to achieve any improvement in forced labor conditions around the world.
As we mentioned, the Supreme Court already struck down a previous set of tariffs that relied on a different legal authority. Do you think these tariffs will survive?
I think it's an open legal question. These tariffs are fundamentally different from the ones that the Supreme Court struck down, because in that case, the court simply had to decide whether the law allows any tariffs at all to be imposed by any president. This time around, the law at issue, Section 301, clearly allows for the use of tariffs by the executive branch. So that forces the court to question the grounds for imposing those tariffs and the analysis conducted. And courts don't really like to do that. They're very deferential to the executive branch and these types of determinations. So I think that there is a case here because the report and the findings are so weak, but it's not nearly as much of a slam dunk as the emergency tariffs were last winter.
So you're worried about a precedent that could be set?
Certainly, because I think one of the real issues here is if you look at how light this report was, if you look at how this analysis was conducted, it could effectively turn any issue into a blank check for the president to write tariffs. And tariffs are the constitutional authority of Congress. So the question becomes, if the president can do this, he can really impose tariffs for any reason and effectively take over Congress's tariff powers.
Scott Linsicum is Vice President of General Economics and Trade at the Cato Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We have been listening to Weekend Edition Saturday. It is here on People Power KAXC. Getting ready for 9 o'clock. We've got a special for you this morning. It is a look back at the music already this so far in 2026. Our music team, it's our director, Kari Headland, along with assistant music director, Malachi Coons, and our volunteer coordinator, Dan Gannon. Spin that ish. Tune in between 9 and 10 o'clock. The music is so local. It is handpicked since 1976, and it is not about algorithms. We can get you that T-shirt as your thank you gift at $240 a year or above. The important thing is you keep it coming this morning. Two more, and we get an extra $500 unlocked. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you to everyone who has pledged so far, including Mary Jane from Minneapolis, John from Omaha, and a confidential member. We'd love to hear from you in Hibbing, in Brainerd, in Bemidji this morning. For as little as $5 a month, you make sure that KAXC keeps going into the future. We're independent, we're local, not part of Minnesota Public Radio. You can go to kaxe.org. We do hear lots of great music, and later today from 4 to 7 o'clock, right after Minnesota Mixtape, it's Kari Headland and her son Anders bringing us On the River. And tonight, Green Cheese Trivia, Heather Johnson will be your host, along with our very own Mike Berry. The final night of the summer membership drive. Get them off to a great start with your pledge right now. Listen guilt-free all day long. 218-326-1234. You can text the word donate.
I dreamt you were holding the head of a rose like it was my breast. You stuck your nose into that flower like your face into my chest, and took a long breath. Then you wrapped around a fig tree like it was my waist. You picked that fruit, peeled it back, and took a taste like it was my face. You looked into the clouds like they were my eyes. You made them blush. The clouds got shy and made a red sky. Then you fell asleep in the dirt like the earth was our bed. You curled up to those rocks like my hands cradling your head. Then I woke up and said,
great music. You hear it here on KEXC. Do your part to support it. Looking for two more right now before 9 o'clock to unlock an extra $500. Thanks to our generous, confidential pledger who wants to make sure KEXC keeps going strong on this August 1st. 218-326-1234. Grab the new music T-shirt as your thank you gift. Just say no to algorithms at $20 a month or above. Go to KEXC.org.
You tighten up just to make that horse dance. Then you run your fingers through its mane like it was my hair. I woke up and hoped that you were there, but the bed was bare.
That Rose by Margaret Glasby. New music from her coming up at 10 o'clock. Tom Daniel is going to be our host for Back Porch Harmony. Keep your phone calls, keep your pledges coming at KEXC.org. The number, 218-326-1234. Another important number is 50 years of people-powered radio, and you can be a part of it with your support now. Help us get an extra match that's on the table. Coming up next, we've got a little What's for Breakfast from Weekend Edition Saturday, learning about a China Bao breakfast.
Or breakfast, plantain in Ecuador, pudding in Syria, today China. Of course, it's a vast and famously diverse country with a wide range of cuisines. But there is one item common to almost every Chinese region, the bun, stuffed with meat, vegetables, or both. And as NPR's Jennifer Pak reports, buns are often a breakfast staple.
It's 8 a.m. on a workday at a shop outside Tuanjiehu Park selling buns or baozi. The line is constant, but it moves fast. Staff pluck stuffed white buns from bamboo steamers, plop them into flimsy plastic bags, piping hot. A repairman takes the buns to his electric scooter. Before I could ask what fillings he got, he's already eaten them and zips off to his next job. Buns are one of the few Chinese foods people here can eat on the go. And they're also affordable. For two soy sauce pork buns, this shop's bestseller, one pickled veg, another with eggplant and green peppers, plus 2 cups of fresh soybean milk, a breakfast for two comes to...
$19.50. It's like about $3.
Breakfast items in China are all relatively cheap.
That's Michael Z, author of Zhao Fan, a book about breakfast in China. His favorite bun comes from a shop in eastern China's Shaoxing City. It starts with buns without a filling, called mantou.
They use a sourdough rice ferment, and they make these incredibly light mantou. And then when you order them, they get a pair of chopsticks, they crack it open, they put a massive chunk of hongsha rou inside.
That's red braised pork, sticky and sweet. For Beijing resident Samantha Zhao, she says pork and fennel buns are her favorite, though she doesn't eat buns as often as before. Baozi is a bit unhealthy, she says. It's easy to eat too many, like four in one go, and they contain quite a bit of dough and oil. But then she couldn't resist when passing by this trendy bun shop called Baoerjiu near Beijing's Confucius Temple and Imperial College. This shop likes to experiment with fillings. Its signature bun piqued the curiosity of NPR's Beijing producer Jasmine Ling.
Chocolate red bean bun.
Not bad.
It's not that sweet.
To stand out from competitors, this shop also holds workshops like these. Where the resident baozi master teaches people to make buns. One of the students is Bai Qiufei. Turns out, he says, it takes a lot of skill to make a simple bun. And making baozi is a good way to disconnect, says the shop's co-founder Lu Yao. A lot of people I know are feeling anxious about the development of AI, she says. Plus, living in Beijing is stressful. Her big dream is to expand overseas. After all, Chinese people are all over the globe. And food, she says, like baozi, is the best way to connect to home. Jennifer Pak, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR News.
Shaboozey has a new album that imagines life in the Wild West, where laws are dust.
This outlaw group came into this town and took over. In the chaos of all that, they accidentally took the life of this sheriff. But what they didn't know is the sheriff had a daughter, and that daughter was coming for vengeance.
The Outlaw, Sherry Lee, and Other Western Tales.
Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
With these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said today his forces sank a Russian container ship in the Black Sea and struck three Russian oil refineries. This followed another Russian missile and drone attack against Ukraine, killing at least 9 people. The search continues for at least 6 climbers missing on Pakistan's Broad Peak. 4 bodies have been found. The team lost contact with its base camp Thursday after an avalanche. And in cycling, it's the first day of the Women's Tour de France. In the U.S., today's the first day for the Women's Pro Baseball League. According to its website, the first game, Los Angeles against New York, is sold out. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Legacy Box, committed to making it easy to revisit and share family memories captured on aging tapes, film, and photos. Converting media into digital files to access for generations to come. LegacyBox.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Some of the 220,000 people who fled wildfires in France are returning to their homes. And here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley on France's largest civilian evacuation since World War II.
The newspaper tobacco shop is open again in the town of Martignas-sur-Jal, just 10 miles west of Bordeaux. I missed you, says a customer to the owner. I missed you all too, she replies from behind the cash register. All around Bordeaux, little towns like this are coming back to life as people return to their homes. This entire town was evacuated a week ago with the fires approaching. Carole Gomez is coming out of the shop. She describes the night they left at midnight. There were tons of ashes coming down, a thick, sticky fog, she says. It was dark and we couldn't find our cat. It was so hard. Gomez becomes emotional talking about the kindness and solidarity of everyone, especially the local officials. Our cat is fine, and it's thanks to a person in the mayor's office who went out and found and fed all the animals that people had to leave behind, she says.
Bonjour. Bonjour, monsieur.
Gomez invites me to come see her house.
Journaliste pour la Radio Publique Américaine.
I get in the car with her and husband, Florent. They've lived here for 51 years and describe a close-knit, friendly community in an idyllic spot between Bordeaux and the Atlantic Ocean, surrounded by pine forests.
We're pulling into their driveway. They have a nice little bungalow stucco house with tile roof, hedges with the garden, and a pebble driveway, opening the gate.
We go inside. There is a light soot coating on her walls. But Kiki is there. She shows me her backyard. Ah, your swimming pool.
Donc, la piscine était noire. Mon mari, depuis ce matin, 6 heures du matin.
The pool was black, she says. My husband's been cleaning since 6 a.m. this morning. But she says none of this matters because at one point she feared she would have nothing to return to at all. The fire incinerated 100,000 acres in the Bordeaux region, and similar fires are raging across Europe amid drought and record temperatures linked to climate change. Church bells ring one village over in Saint-Jean-d'Illac. Next to the church is a fire logistics hub where over the last week the fire trucks were repaired and refilled with gas and water to go back into the flames. Several firefighters lounge in the churchyard, finally getting a break. Romain Citeau is head of this operation.
On a vécu vraiment un élan de
the outpouring of generosity from the population, the farmers, the local businesses has been amazing, he says. Everyone was doing their all to support us. Just then, a family with three kids comes up to give homemade crepes to the firefighters to thank them for what they've done. People here know if their houses are still standing, it's thanks to their bravery. Across from the church, Daphne Madelpech has reopened her graphics and photo studio. She also lives nearby. She says they had to leave fast. I just took the camera, she says. In fact, this evacuation has made me realize that you don't really need any of it, except for the husband, the dog, the cat, your papers, and some cash. It's the human factor that's important, she says. Everywhere we took refuge this week, people were so kind when they found out we were from Bordeaux. And when we returned, all of us neighbors just hugged each other. This is what matters in life. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Saint-Jean-d'Illac, France.
It is 14 minutes before 9 o'clock. Coming up at 9, a special on KEXE. It's Spin That Ish, the best music of 2026 so far from our music team, led by Kari Hedlund. We are asking for your support this morning. It's the final day this August 1st of our summer membership drive, and we need to hear from one more after this to get that match of an extra $500. We just heard from our friend Karen Carls. She is a longtime member of KEXE, and she supports everything that we do, especially the local journalism, and she loves the music. She says, I believe in KEXE and what you have done for so long. Thank you, Karen. So good to talk to you this morning. Now we need to hear from you. One more unlocks an extra $500. Maybe you can afford to give $20 a month to get that brand new t-shirt. Just say no to algorithms as your thank you gift. 218-326-1234. Coming up from Weekend Edition Saturday, we're going to be hearing from musician Lido Pimienta about her new album. And as you get ready for the 9 o'clock special with the KEXE music team. At 10 o'clock, it is Tom Daniel. He's going to be bringing us, as always, a rollicking back porch harmony. It's going to be a lot of fun. You're going to want to keep the momentum going with your pledge right now. 218-326-1234. Because this is People Powered Radio on Northern Minnesota.
Rolling into Angeles, blurred eyes and busted fists. Can I take much more of this? But I can't see the end. Summer sun is fading fast, and the first day now and later pass. In time I'm gonna ride that northern highway to my home. And all this time, all the money that you earned, take you back to the lessons that you love. Is it the highway signs, the county lines, or the roads run in between? I'm falling ever faster, dear my darling, how it be? Well,
This is new music from Wild Horses from Grand Rapids. More from Weekend Edition Saturday up next. Our thanks goes out to Ledger and Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9, Saturday, 5 to 9, Sundays, 10 to 2. LedgerandLadle.com. Now we join Weekend Edition Saturday.
But women's rights, safe sex, and HIV. UNAIDS has even used the show's title character in ads urging people, don't be a Janassi, keep yourself and your partners safe. And in Limpopo province here, a government campaign against gender-based violence uses the tagline, the polygamist shows fiction, gender-based violence and femicide shows consequences, break the cycle. The polygamist mixes scandal with a sharp portrait of modern South Africa, and a show built on sex and secrets is now driving some very real life conversations. Kate Bartlett, NPR News, Johannesburg.
Lito Pimienta thinks a lot about what's considered beautiful. She's a Colombian-Canadian artist and musician.
It's really troubling when the Caribbean or the Caribbean diaspora is spoken about in terms of exoticism or us only being known as these exotic beings that are just lounging by the water, you know? The reality is that we're carriers of immense, sublime beauty.
Her new album explores what she calls the Caribbean sublime. It's called Garabeña. And while it's full of cumbias and other danceable beats, it starts out with a lullaby, Arruyame.
Arruyame, it translates into lull me or hold me. It's another manifestation of human tenderness. It's a song that I wrote in that holy, intimate space and stage with a partner. I have a real problem with heteronormative, just cookie cutter love songs. I always like to make songs that have no gender. I like to write songs where everyone can feel seen.
Right after that, you have the song Tóxica, about a toxic person, certainly not somebody you'd want to welcome into your arms.
No. I wrote it about a very specific person, and that person's MO was that they always put themselves first, no matter what. We all have those people in our lives that we love so much, but we definitely understand after a lot of humiliations that maybe they're not the friend that we thought. My friendships are more intense. Like, I share so much more intensity with my friends than I do with a romantic partner or with, like, any boyfriend. But it's just that it was a moment in my life, and I included it because I needed also to just release myself from that friendship.
Your daughter Martina sings on the song Así Nací. What was that like?
Just turned 7 when she sang on the song. And she did because originally I invited another artist. Our schedules just, it didn't work out. And then one of the producers, he said to me, but I hear your daughter singing Así Nací all the time. Aww. And it was one of her favorite songs. And we were like, well, María José can't make it, but I have my daughter and she can join the song. And she was so proud. I always talk about myself in that I am an artist who happens to be a mother and a mother who happens to be an artist. But motherhood is so important to me, and making space where children are embraced, you know, it's at the core of my practice. And I really believe in that. So that's why Así Nací made so much sense to have my daughter singing in it.
There are notes of resistance on this album. Let me ask you about the song Marea. This is an angry song, isn't it?
It's an anti-colonial song disguised as a love song. There's a lot of layers to these songs. You know when I'm saying Váyanse de mi Isla Bonita? It references La Isla Bonita by Madonna. Because I remember being a child listening to that song and being like, I'm going to the pretty island. Which island? So I feel like it embodies perfectly this like colonial view of Caribbean diaspora, where we are that subject. We know what's happening to our communities and societies, and it's just not fair that suddenly you go to the beach and then there's like a line that you can't cross because someone from the USA or Britain bought the house over there and then they decided that this is going to be their private backyard, and that's just not how it works.
May I point something out as a reporter? I've made a number of trips to Cuba.
Yes.
You know, there are places that Cubans can't go because they keep them just for tourists.
Yeah, because every government is corrupt. Until we can really overhaul those systems that don't work, we're never going to get to liberation. You know, I'm one of the many Colombians that were forced to leave due to violence, displacements, and, you know, like the leftover from colonialism. So I have a deep understanding and a deep hurt that I get to heal when I make this music, when I make songs and art that resonates with people that are going through that same hardship of not being able to wake up every day to the beautiful paradise where you were born.
You're also a visual artist. How does your music get along with your art?
I write music the same way as I paint. I'll have notebooks that are for lyrics, but they're full of drawings. I can trust the drawing more than I can trust my memory. And the melodies too, like I carry melodies more than I can carry someone's name. So having a notebook where I'm writing the music on this page and then the drawings that are related to those words and that music, it keeps me leveled, grounded.
Nido Pimienta, her new album, Caribeña. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We have been listening to Weekend Edition Saturday from National Public Radio. It's here on 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids, Aiken, Hibbing, and Virginia, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, Fauston, Park Rapids, and at 89.9 in Brainerd, Nisswa, Baxter, and Merrifield. You can also listen online at kexe.org. We are 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. The music has been handpicked since 1976. You can do your part now to keep the music rolling. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Coming up, we've got a special from the KEXE music team, and you're going to want to stay tuned. The best music of 2026. And then Tom Daniel, who has entered the building, much like Elvis does, and he will be bringing you Back Porch. And it's going to be a fun day of great music. You're going to want to support it. We almost have made our goal. One more makes it possible to unlock an extra $500 thanks to a generous confidential pledger. Do your part now, 218-326-1234. You can text the word donate to that number and let us know that KAXE matters to you. And you want to keep it going into the year, years and years ahead, as we were the first rural public radio station in the nation in 1976. And despite the loss of federal funding, we keep on going because of people like you who are listening on this beautiful Saturday morning and taking a little extra time to support it. Go to KAXE.org. Mostly sunny skies today with highs 80 to 85 and mostly clear to partly cloudy overnight with temperatures in the low to upper 50s. Sunday, tomorrow, sunny with highs 80 to 84 degrees. We want to thank everyone who pledged so far this morning. Karen from Grand Rapids, Mary Jane from Grand Rapids via Minneapolis, John from Omaha, and our confidential pledger in memorial of Catherine Downing. Also, John from Omaha pledged his support, and it was in memorial of a friend of his as well. We'll take a look here.